Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky prepares to introduce new science education standards.
We don't need kids who can just regurgitate definitions and other people's points of view.
A report on the effects of natural gas fracking is due out soon.
Even though about 3/4 of the flowback fluid is being reused and recycled, which is great, that's only substituting for about 10% of the water withdrawals.
And we hear from two West Virginia writers with books out just in time for the spooky season.
The Redhead murder case was actually famous at the time. It got a lot of publicity all across the country.
That's one of the things I like to do, is to mix horror with Appalachian history and folklore.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky is among several states preparing to introduce new science standards in public schools, but there's opposition from a vocal minority. Kentucky Public Radio's Devin Katanyama has more on the challenges that face Kentucky as it once again leads the charge in changing what and how students learn science.
The standards aren't just about teaching evolution. They're about imparting analytical skills. They're more about the scientific method than about memorizing the atomic number for boron.
It's not saying just, you know, tell us the difference between a solid, a liquid, and a gas, because any kid could Google that.
This is Karen Kidwell. She's in charge of implementing the new standards for the Kentucky Department of Education.
We don't need kids who can just regurgitate definitions and other people's points of view or ideas about how the way the world works.
It's those points of view that have caused trouble. The Next Generation Science Standards, NGSS, were developed by an independent non-governmental group of 26 states, including Kentucky. They're similar to the new Common Core standards in English and math that have now been adopted by most states. But science hits a nerve for some Kentuckians, and many opponents of NGSS let their voices be heard at a public hearing this year.
Evolution as fact is a lie.
Everybody knows that there is a creator.
The writers of the NGSS are behind the curve.
My child will never step foot in a public school.
Kentucky already includes evolution in its current standards, and the vast majority of scientists back it up. That's also why there are more lessons on climate change, too.
They're confusing science with other ways of thinking.
Tom Treader is a professor at the University of Louisville and was part of Kentucky's team that reviewed and made recommendations for NGSS.
A religious way of thinking is not in conflict with a scientific way of thinking. It's simply different. And so any teacher or a group of teachers who choose to ignore the best science and choose to teach non-scientific ideas, they're really doing a disservice for their kids.
Kentucky's education department received thousands of written and recorded comments, many from scientific organizations and educators. Only 300 were in opposition. But that didn't stop a small legislative committee from rejecting the NGSS standards in a 5-1 vote in September. Governor Steve Beshear quickly said he would veto that decision, a move that was commended by Education Commissioner Terry Holliday. A larger interim education committee could have also voted on the standards this month, but it declined to do so. And co-chair Representative Derek Graham says it's a done deal. On the other side of the argument, some say the standards aren't advanced enough. The Thomas B. Fordham Institute, which supported the Common Core standards, has given the NGSS a C grade, which is better than the D grade it gave to Kentucky's science standards. President Chester Finn Jr. says there are model states like Massachusetts and South Carolina that have really good standards.
The NGSS folks made a conscious decision to give greater priority to what they would call the practice of science rather than the knowledge of science. And they believe that's the right way for science education to head. And I guess our reviewers don't agree.
That's not really assessing what people understand about science.
Josh Rosenau is the policy director at the National Center for Science Education.
And that doesn't help people be lifelong science learners and appreciate the relevance of science to their lives.
Rosenau says at least 7 states have already adopted the standards to some degree, but other states are being very careful.
Everybody is watching what everyone does at this point.
Kentucky's been called a leader for being the first to implement the Common Core standards in English and math. It's also among the first states to adopt the NGSS, but Rosenau calls Kentucky's approval the most contentious so far. State lawmakers could open up the issue for discussion when the General Assembly is back in January, but the Education Department is already preparing to implement the standards, and Governor Beshear has made clear his intent to move forward.
A new art exhibit at Morehead State University features interpretations and techniques of contemporary drawing. Kentucky Public Radio's Paul Hitchcock reports.
Currently on display in the Claypool Young Art Gallery at Morehead State University is an exhibition entitled A Fine Line, Contemporary Drawing. Open to the public through November 29th, the exhibition showcases the conceptual and media possibilities in drawing, ranging from pencil, ink, paint, textile, sculpture, and other alternative materials. Jennifer Rice is an assistant professor of art and the director of the Claypool Young Art Gallery. She says this show features a wide variety of conceptual art and an interesting cross-selection of contemporary art.
There are many pieces in the show that are just phenomenal in technique. A petite drawing, a very large scale, figurative work. There are some pieces in the show that makes me wonder, you know, how did they do that? And I think that that is a really interesting thing and exciting thing to think when you're looking at a piece of art.
And pushing the boundaries of traditional media, Rice says she wanted an exhibition that would expand the concept of drawing.
That they be dependent online as a mode of visual communication. So in the show we have works that are made with paint, we have prints, we have encaustic, which is painting with wax, textile pieces, just collage, sculpture.
The juror for A Fine Line was Ann Harris, renowned contemporary painter and instructor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Working from more than 300 pieces submitted for consideration, ultimately just 55 were selected for the show. Harris explains her selection process and describes it as a magical experience.
I define drawing as an organization of marks that serve to transform a ground. The transformation is key. And so I looked for work that did that in some respect, because it's a kind of magic. You make a mark and it turns this white piece of paper into something else. I just look for that kind of magic.
Terrell Thompson, a graduate art student at Morehead State University, says she is amazed by the variety in the show.
Really impressed by the show because the theme of it was line, and each artist really took that theme to heart and they each brought a whole different direction to line.
And Thompson says she hopes the show will inspire other art students in their own creations.
To get them to think about different ways that they themselves can use line in their own work to create something extraordinary like these artists did.
Tara Madden, a junior from London, Kentucky, is a studio art major at Morehead State University. She says the show pushes the traditional concept of contemporary line drawings and will use the show as inspiration.
I just love seeing the pieces, seeing the techniques the artists use. You can actually just learn so much by observing. Maybe I can add those different techniques into my own work and grow from that.
A Fine Line contemporary drawing is on display through November 29th. Viewing hours are weekdays from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. or by appointment. In association with the exhibit, artist Tammy Beldew from Black Mountain, North Carolina, will be speaking on her figurative drawings, paintings, and prints. Her lectures will take place on Friday, November 8th in room 111 of the Claypool Young Art Building. All events are free and open to the public. Reporting for Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Paul Hinchcock.
The Lumberjackin' Bluegrass and Jamboree was in full swing earlier this month at Twin Falls State Park. As West Virginia Public Radio's Brian Allen reports, the annual event includes speed competition, vendors, and of course, bluegrass music.
Get set, go!
Three school clubs from Penn State, Virginia Tech, and West Virginia University competed in various team events, such as log roll, cross-cutting, chainsaw, bolt-splitting, and chopping. The students' participation exposes them to the timber industry. Twin Falls activity coordinator Brian Danford oversaw the student competition.
All these students are learning how to basically what people did in the olden days, because they used cross-cut saws and hand axes in order to fell trees. Nowadays, it's more mechanized, and they have chainsaws and everything else in order to get the wood out. But we want to teach them the culture, and so and get them some good competition.
The co-ed teams competed for most of the day.
There were male, female, and co-ed events, including the Jack and Jill competition, where a male and female cross-cut saw team would go against a team from another school. The Jamboree celebrated its 31st year. It's a community event that focuses on the importance of the timber industry in West Virginia. According to the West Virginia Forestry Association, the industry contributes just over $3 billion to the state's economy. Traditionally, timber ranks as one of West Virginia's largest major industries following coal. When the Western Virginia, now West Virginia, virgin forests were discovered, they were filled with large trees, some reaching heights of 140 feet and 27 feet in diameter, which included oak, maple, poplar, and the American chestnut. The chestnuts were killed off in the early 20th century by a fungus. Efforts are currently underway by the American Chestnut Foundation to restore the tree. Other trees under attack include the state's hardwoods by the gypsy moth and hemlock trees by the hemlock woolly adelgid. The West Virginia Department of Agriculture is working to combat the adelgid through chemicals and natural predators. But Amanda Cadle, who was watching the competition, shared a unique way of replanting hemlock trees, which she learned from a family friend.
And so my friend, wanting to preserve the memory of his father, took his idea and cut some branches off of that tree right after they cut it. Probably about the size of a seedling, you know, about this big around. You just take a hatchet and you just kind of split the end and you just plant it in fertile soil.
Cadle added that soaking the branches in water before planting them is helpful. She says her technique is working. However, her trees are in an isolated area, away from the adelgids, at a lower elevation, and therefore in a somewhat protected environment. Whether or not her technique will work in other locations remains to be seen. In addition to the Lumberjack and Jill competition, the Lumberjack and Bluegrass and Jamboree held a variety of other attractions including vendors' arts and crafts, bluegrass music, square dancing, and hay rides. The three-day Jamboree usually hosts around 3,500 visitors. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Brian Allen at Twin Falls State Park.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The Horizontal Well Control Act of 2011 requires studies be conducted to gain a better understanding of the effects of the natural gas drilling that's sweeping northern West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and other states. Those reports are coming due, and this past week, legislators in West Virginia got a sneak peek from scientists who have been looking into the matter. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board reports.
Michael McCauley is the interim chairman of the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health from the School of Public Health at West Virginia University. He presented recommendations based on the air, noise, and light study he published earlier this summer. McCauley says the major surprise his study revealed were copious amounts of benzene detected by his air monitors. The monitors were set up at the current legal setback distance of 625 feet from the center of the drilling pads. His report notes that at one site, benzene levels were detected of up to 85 parts per billion. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health recommends workers regularly exposed to 100 parts per billion wear respiratory protection. So why worry about benzene? Well, substantial quantities of epidemiologic, clinical, and laboratory data link benzene to aplastic anemia, acute leukemia, and bone marrow abnormalities.
Now, we suspect that benzene may be coming, in fact, from diesel engines because a lot of fracking sites have truck traffic going in and out of them. And also during the actual hydraulic fracturing itself, there are a number of diesel engines that are sitting on the pad being run at high rates.
Based on his findings, McCauley made suggestions to lawmakers. McCauley says the current required setback distance is a regulation that should be abandoned. The aim of the rule is to protect people in the vicinity from exposure, but he says an arbitrary number won't achieve that given the variability of topography and considering that pollution doesn't always come from the center of the pad. A better idea? Control the emissions. To that end, McCauley submits that monitoring real-time emissions is likely the smartest, most effective tool to employ, especially around sensitive areas like houses, hospitals, and schools. Monitoring would allow high levels of pollutants to be addressed immediately by the people controlling the operation. And his recommendation for noise pollution? control the noise. That's the sound of a horizontal drilling pad in Marshall County. That's about half a mile away.
We were seeing short-term exposures exceeding 100 decibels around some of these sites. 100 decibels is kind of the level of a rock band. So you don't want a rock band outside your bedroom window. Although the long-term exposures were below 70 decibels on average for the sampling period that we saw, there were still levels that exceeded 70 decibels for brief periods of time. But those brief periods of time can be a concern, particularly if they're disturbing sleep or if they're really loud.
An expert in public health, McCulley explains that 55 decibels is enough to interrupt sleep, which in turn could result in hypertension or high blood pressure, already endemic in the state, especially in the northern panhandle. He says noise pollution needs to be taken into account when constructing these sites and also when considering the traffic patterns to and from them. So switching gears here, water use is another area of concern for legislators. Evan Hansen, president of Downstream Strategies, conducted a study on water use in hydraulic fracturing operations in and around the state. He and his colleagues set out to analyze water use data provided by natural gas drillers to the Department of Environmental Protection, data they're required to provide as per the 2011 law. Hansen says, according to the data, the average Marcellus well in West Virginia injects about 5 million gallons of water into the wells as fracking fluid. 8% of that comes back up. He says the DEP and the industry should be applauded for adopting new recycling practices, as about 75% of that flowback is now being reused. He says the remainder is disposed of in deep well injections.
Even though about 3/4 of the flowback fluid is being reused and recycled, which is great, that's only substituting for about 10% of the water withdrawals. So while great progress has been made in increasing the amount of recycling, that's not taking care of the vast quantities of water that still need to be withdrawn from West Virginia streams.
Hansen adds that tracking this waste should continue to be a priority. West Virginia already sees 100 million gallons of wastewater each year, and in Pennsylvania, across the border where the industry is significantly more developed, they see nearly 1 billion gallons of waste each year. Hansen also sees several areas of improvement regarding data collection and reporting requirements. He says the quality of the data should be improved. He and his team found many mistakes and suggests the DEP take steps to improve industry reporting. He adds many operators also aren't submitting data within required timeframes. But Hansen says his biggest concern is that West Virginia law only requires operators to report flowback water. It's a different story in Pennsylvania, where flowback water only accounts for 38% of reported waste.
In West Virginia, because only flowback fluid is reported and the other types of waste are not reported, we still don't really have a handle on how much waste is being generated and where it's going. So we're still operating in some uncertainty about what's going on in the real world, and that's not a great place to be if you're trying to get the right policies in place to protect water resources.
Hansen says his report will be made available on October 30th. That day, he will also conduct an online webinar explaining his findings, and that webinar is open to the public. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Because of shale gas, the U.S. has become the cheapest place in the world to make plastic. This has led to more than $100 billion in investment along the Gulf Coast in colossal new petrochemical plants that take natural gas and break it into the raw material to make plastic. Western Pennsylvania may get its own taste of these cracker plants if Shell builds one in Beaver County. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier took a trip to the Gulf to see what the impact may be if the plant is built in Pennsylvania.
Standing beneath what looks like an enormous HVAC system, Andy Miller points to a large metal box above him. A furnace burns at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit inside the box.
If you look up into this little peephole, you'll be able to see some of the firing that goes on within a furnace.
I look up into a hole the size of a quarter. there's an orange glow coming from inside.
But as you can see, this is where we actually crack the material into the products that we desire.
Miller is a unit manager for BASF at the company's plant in Port Arthur, Texas. The plant here makes ethylene. This is like the granddaddy of all plastic and many chemicals as well. You know that milk jug you've got in your fridge or the antifreeze in your car? Well, all of these products started their lives in a place just like this.
This is where we start to build the building blocks to make those products.
The plant was built 15 years ago to process crude oil into ethylene. But it recently underwent a facelift. It added some new equipment. Plant manager Greg Masika points me to some of it.
What you see over here with this whole unit is a vaporizer.
The vaporizer takes ethane, a key component of natural gas, and readies it for processing. The cracker heats the ethane up so hot that it cracks. Literally, the molecular bonds holding it together that have actually held it together for eons start to break apart and reform it into ethylene. When it was built, oil was the preferred raw material for the plant. Natural gas was just too expensive. But that changed a couple years ago, thanks to a drilling boom brought on by fracking. Once $12 per 1,000 cubic feet, the price of natural gas has dropped, and it's now between $3 and $4. As a result, chemical plants around the Gulf are expanding, or, like BASF, switching from oil to natural gas as the raw material of choice. Shell's proposed a brand new ethylene plant in Beaver County in western Pennsylvania. It's one of seven brand new ethane crackers planned for the U.S. The plant would take ethane from the Marcellus Shale and convert it into ethylene, and other plastic units could be built alongside it. Industry experts all agree fracking is good news for the American chemical industry.
This is a huge deal. It's a great amount of expansion, all based on the premise that you're going to have these low-cost natural gas feedstocks for some time.
Joe Chang is global editor of ICIS Chemical Business, a trade publication. Chang estimates that the industry will expand in the U.S. by a whopping 38% in the next decade.
It really has changed everything for the U.S. chemical sector and, increased their prospects on a global basis.
Almost overnight, America has become one of the cheapest places in the world to make plastic. That has the petrochemical industry here giddy. It's planned over $100 billion in new investments and predicting a big jobs impact. But few of these jobs will actually occur at the plants themselves. After all, a new plant has a lot of automation, and it only needs a few hundred workers to run it. But there are lots of other jobs that are created outside of the plant itself. A few miles from the BASF plant, workers at DeBusk Services Group take a break between service calls. Randall Delahousie is the safety director here. He said the Port Arthur region suffered after the BP oil spill cooled off drilling in the Gulf. But drilling's coming back, and expanding petrochemical plants have kept his shop and the local economy humming.
There's a whole lot more motels in the area, businesses. You know, the businesses stay packed. So the area around here has been booming pretty good.
His company uses industrial pressure washers to clean out pipes at big petrochemical plants and refineries. More plants and more units means more work for him and his crew of 50 or so.
As they put in more exchangers, more towers, and it's just more things to break, to go in and clean.
The expansion of chemical plants in the Gulf is good news for its economy. But it's also happening in a region where the industry has had a mixed environmental record. Port Arthur is an oil town, and the city's ringed with a dozen industrial plants and refineries. The city used to fall short of federal air quality standards, but it's met those standards the past 8 years because companies have cut down their emissions. And any new plants have to demonstrate they'll use tighter pollution controls before they're allowed to build. But the plants in Port Arthur still release nearly 4 million pounds of hazardous chemicals into the air every year, according to the EPA. That has some who live near the plants worried that the air is bad for them. Jason Warrior is 28. He lives in Carver Terrace, a public housing project in the city's predominantly black west side.
This is an asthma pump that my daughter right here uses.
What's your name, sweetheart?
Michaela.
Michaela, who's six, uses the pump twice a week. The neighborhood is near several chemical plants and the biggest refinery in the country. The EPA says the air quality here is good, but a door-to-door survey conducted by a local community group a few years ago found that one in four households here has a child with asthma. Warrior moved here 3 years ago to look for work in one of the plants, but hasn't been able to find any so far. Both he and six-year-old Michaela got asthma when they moved here. These apartments are slated to be torn down. Some have mold inside, which can also exacerbate breathing problems. Warrior doesn't know what's caused his asthma, but he thinks the dark smoke he sometimes sees coming out of the plants may have something to do with it. The smoke comes during unplanned events, like a power outage, when a unit is forced to burn off chemicals and fuel for safety reasons. According to state records, smaller events can happen on a nearly weekly basis here. Sometimes, Warrior says, the flares at the plants light up the streets in the middle of the night.
Probably like 2-3 in the morning, something like that, they start burning them off. You'll see the whole apartment look around here just light up.
It's a site that means jobs and work for many in this community. With new plants in the works, it's a site that many along the Gulf, and possibly Pennsylvania, will be seeing more of in the near future. In Port Arthur, Texas, I'm Reed Frazier for the Allegheny Front.
This is the first story in a four-part series by the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh. The series is paid for in part by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Next week's report looks at how Houston struggled to clean its air. There are plenty of Pennsylvania landowners who do not want gas companies to drill underneath their properties, even if it means not cashing in on the natural gas rush. State Impact Pennsylvania's Kate Culinary has the story of one couple who held out, but found out by accident a gas company's plans for their land.
It all started with beans. Joyce and Steve Leibel run a small orchard on their 63 acres in Susquehanna County, where they sell fruit and organic vegetables. One day in early September, a friend came by to purchase 10 pounds of green bush beans.
In this area, with all the drilling going on, the conversations usually end up talking about the gas industry. And as I recall, he just brought up that he had seen, he's a borough councilman, and they received a packet of information about a well pad behind our house.
A map the gas company sent to the municipality shows a plan for a well pad just over the hill beyond the thick row of trees at the back of their property. A dotted line shows a well bore moving 2,000 feet across their land.
Well, I didn't believe it at first.
I just thought this has to be some sort of horrible mistake. Someone made a mistake, and we have to enlighten them so they can fix it.
They contacted the Department of Environmental Protection. The DEP said it would contact the gas company, Talisman Energy, to let it know about the situation.
Within hours, we had a phone call, and not directly from Talisman, but from a landman saying he represented Talisman.
Joyce Leibel said he wanted to know what it would take for them to sign a lease. It turns out when the DEP is evaluating a permit, it doesn't have to check whether the gas company has secured drilling rights. The agency approved the permit and informed the couple they had 30 days to file an appeal. That left them with two choices. They could hire a lawyer to appeal, or they could consider signing a lease. The Leibels say several companies have contacted them over the last 5 years. At first, they always said no. But as more of their neighbors leased their properties for drilling, the couple agreed they'd only consider it if they got a good rate and if it didn't involve disturbing anything on the surface of their property.
If a lease actually met these minimal requirements for us to look at it, does that mean we would actually write our names down on that paper? It would definitely be the hardest thing we've ever done in our lives to do that. So I still don't know. But I don't know. I just don't know.
A spokeswoman for Talisman Energy says there's a difference between the permitting process and the drilling process. In other words, just because the company got a permit doesn't mean it intended to drill without getting a valid lease. Jackie Root is president of the Pennsylvania chapter of the National Association of Royalty Owners. She's also known as the gas well guru and has made a living out of helping landowners in the Marcellus Shale region negotiate leases.
Ultimately, Talisman didn't do anything wrong. They didn't trespass on anybody's property. And they, I believe, would not certainly have drilled that lateral without having a lease in place.
Root says companies have to be cautious because drilling without permission would be a very expensive mistake. But Joyce and Steve Leibel say landowners should be protected.
Certainly the landowners whose land is being used for the well should receive a copy of the map and know that the well is being applied for. It's outrageous that that isn't already happening.
For the Leibels, there is a somewhat satisfying ending to this story. Talisman canceled the permit from the DEP. A spokeswoman for the company says it was done as a courtesy to the landowners. Katie Culinary, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And the public face of Pennsylvania's natural gas industry has a new leader. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Kusick reports on the change at the Marcellus Shale Coalition.
David Spiegelmeyer is a former vice president of government relations for Chesapeake Energy's Appalachia division. He'll be following in the footsteps of Catherine Klaber, who announced she was leaving her role as MSC president in July. Spiegelmeyer was chairman of the MSC's executive board until last August, when he was laid off from Chesapeake during a massive restructuring of the company. Coalition spokesman Steve Ford says Spiegelmeyer has more than 30 years' experience working in the energy industry and is a good fit for the job.
You're not going to find somebody who's a more passionate champion of Pennsylvania natural gas than Dave. He's a native Pennsylvanian, and he's someone that is well-respected in Harrisburg and communities across the Commonwealth, and it's going to be a very positive step for industry as a whole, having him at the helm here at the MSC.
Governor Corbett's energy executive, Patrick Henderson, echoes those sentiments.
We look forward to working with Dave on safe, responsible shale development here in Pennsylvania.
The coalition was formed in 2008 and is the main trade group representing Pennsylvania's natural gas industry. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
For more information about the environment, go to stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Just in time for Halloween, a book of ghosts and mystery stories by a West Virginia writer. John Douglas of Berkeley Springs is the former editor of the Morgan County Messenger newspaper, and his new book is called A Fog of Ghosts, Haunted Tales and Odd Pieces.
I started writing ghost stories back in the mid-1970s when I started working for the Morgan Messenger newspaper. And every Halloween, I would put in a ghost story, and people loved them. The years I didn't do it, they asked where it was. And sometimes I would make them up. Sometimes I made them up the night before they were in print. And sometimes I used local legends or stories that people told me about their own haunted house. And so I decided when I retired that I'd tried to collect all these things, and I decided to put out the book of ghost stories.
So this is a compilation of some of the stories that you already ran in the Messenger, or are they new, or both?
They're both. There's probably a dozen stories in here that were from the Morgan Messenger in the past, and then several new ones. Then there's a middle section that's about an unsolved murder from 1950 called the Redhead Murder Saga. And then there's an autobiographical section about why I got interested in ghost stories and some of the ghost stories I tried to track down as a reporter. And then it ends with a Civil War story, sort of an odd Civil War story that I wrote years ago.
So you mentioned part of it is about how you became interested in ghost stories. So why did you become interested in them?
I think when I was a kid growing up in Cumberland, Maryland, I just heard the old people talk, and my grandfather and other relatives were from Western Maryland, coal mining people and railroading people, and some of them were from Morgan County, West Virginia, and I just heard all their old stories. And then when we first got a TV set, you know, you had Sherlock Holmes and programs like that on back in the 50s, and it just something I loved.
You mentioned the redheaded woman. That's an unsolved cold case from Berkeley Springs from 1950. And you have an actual story about the truth about what happened, followed by your ghost story, correct?
Well, it's not a ghost story, but it's a mystery type story. Yeah, the Redhead murder case was actually famous at the time. It got a lot of publicity all across the country. The difficulty with it was they didn't know who the victim was. They found a naked redhead's body near the Potomac River, right over the Potomac River Bridge from Hancock, Maryland. And when you don't know who the victim is, it's very difficult to figure out who the killer is. And so to this day, they don't know who the victim is. She had red hair and an appendectomy scar, and there were, you know, various things that they used to describe her. They circulated a picture of her. She looked a lot like Joan Crawford. And they circulated a picture of her to newspapers so that people might be able to identify her, but nobody ever came up with a great identification. About 6 years ago, maybe, the cold case investigator for West Virginia got a call. A family had read about one of my newspaper articles about the Redhead murder. I would put them in the paper occasionally and remind people it was still unsolved. And somebody had read one of these and thought that it might be their grandmother. And the family hadn't seen the grandmother since 1940. And she had red hair and an appendectomy scar, and everything seemed to fit the bill. And so they actually exhumed her body, the body of the redhead, which was buried in Greenway Cemetery in Berkeley Springs. Judge David Sanders signed an exhumation order, and the state police dug the body up. They did a DNA test. They found it wasn't that woman, but the DNA results are now on file, so that if anybody would make a claim in the future that it might be a relative, they could check it without having to go through all the digging up the body and everything.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed is the difference in the style of writing from the chapter that talks about the actual case to the chapter where you concocted the mystery. The backstory and your imagination, you sort of take your journalist hat off and put your fiction writer hat on there?
That's exactly it. The stories are, though they're about the same case, they're written differently, they're told differently. And the fiction version sort of points you toward one possible solution of it.
Do you have a favorite story in the book?
I'm sort of partial to the last story. It's called Find Virginia Line, about a man who returns to his childhood home after wandering the world, and is in a valley in West Virginia. It's fictionally called Clinton Valley, though it's a lot like Doe Gully. And he just remembers an anecdote from his family's past where his great-great-grandfather tried to stop a Civil War battle in the middle of their cornfield. And I'm sort of partial to that. And then there's a story that's also about the Civil War. That's one of the ghost stories. It's a girl named Maggie Rose, Magdalene Rose. And Maggie Rose had this thing about Stonewall Jackson. It was set in 1862. And she wanted to see Stonewall Jackson when he was leading his forces from Winchester, Virginia, through West Virginia, up to Hancock, Maryland. And so she hid in the stream, Sleepy Creek, and she tried to get a glimpse of Stonewall Jackson as he went by. The trouble was, the soldiers were making so much noise, and there's cannons going by, and people riding by, and people marching by, and one of the soldiers thought he saw a rabbit. So unfortunately, Maggie Rose was the rabbit. And so as she lay dying, the troops are going by, and she's calling for help, and nobody stops. And so if you go out the Route 13, the old Winchester Road, and get to that bridge, sometimes you can hear this faint voice calling for help.
Is this a true ghost story or something you just decided would be interesting?
Well, the history of it's true. That's the way Stonewall Jackson went from Winchester to Hancock in 1862. The rest of it, my wife and I made up as we were driving out there one night and thought we heard a whistle as we went by the bridge. And it's funny, there's a Michigan college professor who was doing a Stonewall Jackson tour. And so he was doing some legwork in this area to figure out where he was going to take his people. He called me up a couple years after the story was in the paper. It was one of my Halloween ghost stories. And he said, you know, all the old people out there on Winchester Grade Road, tell me about this old story that, you know, about the girl being shot who wanted to glimpse of Stonewall Jackson. And I just had to laugh. He wanted to know the exact location so they could stop there on these historical bus tour. And I did tell him that it was something that, far from being old, was only about 2 years old at the time.
That has to be fun, though.
Yes, that's fun. Yeah.
Now, do you believe in ghosts yourself?
I think there's things we can't explain, but I don't know that I believe in ghosts. I think people's minds play, I wouldn't say they play tricks, but, you know, we carry things around in our mind, and we superimpose our own minds on the places we are.
John Douglas, thanks for talking with us about your book.
Thank you.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In the tradition of old dime store novels, West Virginia State University student Frank Larnard has edited and published a book of short stories. Hills of Fire, Bare Knuckle Yarns of Appalachia features 12 authors that showcase Appalachians as heroes. Larnard sat down with West Virginia Public Radio's Beth Voorhees to talk about folklore, monsters, and horror that inspires this book and his work.
The book is an anthology of 12 different stories from 12 different authors, some from here in the state and some from all around the world. And each one of them is an action-adventure story kind of based on the pulp traditions from the 30s through the 50s of, you know, high-octane, square-jawed heroes and dangerous dames and dastardly villains, but all set here in Appalachia with Appalachian people as the heroes.
In your introduction to Hills of Fire, Bare Knuckle Yarns of Appalachia, you write, "Appalachia hasn't always gotten the reputation it deserves. Often the hard-working people of the Appalachian Mountains are portrayed in unflattering stereotypes as ignorant, barefoot, backward, toothless, and worse. I'd like to change that. I love these hills and the folks who live here. No matter how they are portrayed by Hollywood, I know the Appalachian people to be rugged, independent, honest, and brave. With this anthology and the help of 12 amazing writers, I'd like to remind the world of what they have forgotten. This is a place of legends and heroes." What do you mean by that?
One of the things that I wanted to do with the anthology was to create characters and stories where Appalachian people are the heroes. We come from a long line of heroes, people like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, and Appalachia was once the center for action and adventure in all of America, and now we've kind of been denigrated to toothless cannibals or, you know, shoeless meth heads, you know, in a lot of mainstream media. So I wanted to, you know, kind of take a step back and go back to the roots of Appalachia and you know, what it really means to be an Appalachian person, you know, trying to survive in this rugged landscape.
There are 12 stories in this book. Do you have a favorite?
It's like asking which one of my kids is my favorite.
I know, but you got to ask anyway.
There are a lot that I really like in there. There's a story about a female pro wrestler that I'm a big fan of. And for me, Appalachian women are very strong and really really great characters, but you don't see too much of them, especially in a action-adventure setting. So that story I really enjoyed. But all of them are really lots of fun. I had so much fun putting the anthology together.
In the section about the editor, it says you were born in Knoxville, Tennessee, and spent much of your childhood engrossed in weird stories of monsters, mutants, and other worlds. You've worked as a morgue night watchman. What was that like?
That was an interesting experience. Probably one of the easiest jobs I've ever had because customer service is, you know, really pretty much non-existent in it. But I worked the midnight shift and would have to receive bodies and tag them and put them back in the cooler. And it definitely led to some inspiration for a few of my other stories and was a very kind of different job.
You're best known for your unique blend of traditional Appalachian folklore and unsettling horror. Explain.
There's so much folklore in Appalachia and West Virginia. It, as a writer, it's the wellspring that never runs dry. Anytime I need a new story, all I have to do is do a little bit of research and, you know, the stories just come flooding out. So what I like to do is take traditional Appalachian folktales and maybe put a modern twist on them and bring them back into the present. Or
Can you give me an example?
I'm a student at West Virginia State University, and a lot of people don't know that at one time the campus was a slave plantation. And the more I started to read into that, the more I wanted to tell a story about Appalachian slaves in West Virginia. And so I kind of used that as a jumping point to kind of create my own mythological idea and kind of combine the horror of slavery with the horror of the supernatural. And that story garnished me my second Giardina Prize at West Virginia State University and was a big accomplishment for me. But that's one of the things I like to do is to mix horror with Appalachian history and folklore.
Why do you think people like horror?
I think it's the same reason why people like roller coasters. There's a sense of thrill to horror. And I think a lot of times we face our fears in safe ways. And by reading stories or watching movies that are scary, sometimes we can, you know, confront the things that frighten us, you know, simple things like the dark or you know, open water or anything like that. But books and television allow us to do it in a relatively safe manner.
Tell me about Frank Larnard's Hillbilly Horror Show. This is your business card.
That's my business card there. Kind of going back to the drawing it from Appalachia, hillbilly horror for me is a longstanding tradition of kind of rustic rural settings mixed with horror, and so it's one of the things that I love to write about.
Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily ghost stories.
Not necessarily ghost stories all the time. Appalachia has plenty of monsters, wampus cats and tailypos and all kinds of interesting things. So whether or not it's early Appalachian settler mythology or Native American. I think as a writer, there's so much you can, you know, pull from for inspiration and creating new stories.
Frank Larnard, the book is Hills of Fire, Bare Knuckle Yarns of Appalachia, published by Woodland Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, State Impact, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our new website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.